5-minute bit of introduction, tell you where I'm coming from, and then when I do make some remarks at the end...
Oh, I forgot to tell you, have we started?
We have started.
When I do make remarks at the end about their two papers, I might refer to my book, which I've got three copies of up here. If anybody at the end of this thing would like to buy a copy of my book, it costs $30, author's price. But you don't have to buy the book. I also have in the book, you know, the essence of the book boiled down to about 5 pages here that I will give you when I finish talking, and that I also have been able to display up here on the board, on the screen. And just briefly, because we're going to have one person talking about Central America, the other person talking about Yemen, and let me just substitute for a moment here. I like the Latin America focus. My book studies 34 examples of American intervention into other countries around the world, and most of them have been in the Western Hemisphere, 13 out of the 34. These are since World War II, since 1945. And I argue in the book on a couple of places that Latin America, the Western Hemisphere, and how we were the regional hegemon in that part of the world, going back to at least 1902, where he's going to begin, maybe even before that, is the model and the template for what we did after 1945 elsewhere in the world. But even if you just focus on 1945 and the 34 interventions that I studied, half of which are probably familiar to you, like Lebanon and South Vietnam and Nicaragua, and some might be more obscure. You might not know that we overthrew the government of Australia, for example, in 1975. I have 34 cases. Most of them, 13, are in the Western Hemisphere, but then there are others. And so today you're going to hear about some of these Western Hemisphere interventions, and you're going to hear about Yemen, which does not appear there because that book came out in 2008, and this is as of 2006. And just to get to the main point of my book, and I'll stop talking, you've seen the geographic division of the cases, but I have 5 tables, which I will give you all a copy of before we start the proceedings today. And if you have no use for this, just please give it back to me at the end. But if, on the other hand, you want to take notes and keep these tables, tables 1 through 5 is the last table, you know, for your own edification, you certainly want to keep it. But because I'm an emeritus professor now, no longer have access to a Xerox machine, I don't have a lot of these 5-page packets any longer. So these are some of my last 10 or 12 that I have. And as I say, this is only about, I think I have 8 of them here, and there's only about 8 people in the room. If you want to follow along, and then if you don't find them interesting at all, you can give them back to me at the end.
We're going to be talking this way. You can add live behind us.
Let me just give you the version of my book. And I'll turn it over to some people.
That's fine, yeah.
First, I was going to say, I don't have Yemen here, because I stopped in 2006, and we haven't done Yemen until, you know, just recently, since 2006. But whether we're talking about Yemen or one of the many Latin American cases, you can always use my tables. If you have copies of the 5 tables, with the 2 panelists here also. And you can put into some context one of the things that I measure, because I'm actually trained as a political scientist, so there are these tables are filled with numbers. The rest of the book, after chapter 1, where all the tables and the numbers are found, is straight historical chronology. You know, it says, look at the title, American Adventurism Abroad, Intervention Since World War II. And my political science friends look at this and say, oh, that's just a history book. They don't really respect history professors that much. And as I get older, what I used to teach as political science in the 70s, like the Vietnam War, by the 90s, it was history, and I was in the Department of History and Politics, so I appreciate both. This I consider a historical book because at least it's chronological, but the first chapter is full of all these numbers, the most important of which is the number of people associated with American policy deaths as a result of these interventions. Americans are responsible for more people killed in the Holocaust, 7.8 million. Most of them being in South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, I mean, about half. But there's a lot of others that can be talked about there, too. And I thought I'd mention that today because some people, starting with Colonel Wright last night, was talked about the unfortunate recipients of our American attention when we do intervene in these places, that you think it comes back and we have some wounds here in the United States, like 50,000 people dead in from Vietnam and 50,000 people dead from Korea. But just think about how many Koreans have died, how many Vietnamese have died, not to mention Nicaraguans, Yemenis, and all the rest. So there's the numbers, if you ever want the numbers. I also say we go in and we destroy their politics, put their politics on hold, put on dictators and so on, which, you know, takes a country like Chile out of the normal political process from 1973 to 1989. And then there's other places that lasted much longer than that, the Congo for 35 years and so on. So I'm going to stop talking just to let you know that I'm going to try to put what these two people, the men, say into this context of the interventions that I've studied, the 34 of them here since World War II. And without further ado, I think I will stop. And I wanted to start with Roger Peace of Tallahassee Community College. He's listed first. He also starting in an earlier historical time. Because one of the titles of his paper, you know, starts in 1904 with the Roosevelt Corollary. And without further ado, you've got it.
Okay. Thank you. Peace is my real name, so you don't have to ask. And I go to a History Against War, Historians Against War, Peace Conferences. third generation just happens to be the case. What Michael's saying about, you know, his graph about casualties is sort of starting formally here, is very important for what we're trying to do is change the consciousness of the American public, you know, and maybe most immediately in your classrooms or in the people that you're with and activist groups, but pointing out the casualties and also having voices from communities that are affected by U.S. foreign policies. And the other side of the guns, you might say, that's very important. Also the contradictions when, you know, we go out for a Cold War that is designed to support democracy and freedom and we end up supporting dictators and overthrowing democratic regimes. Those are things that are somewhat inexplicable to a good part of the public, but we need to reframe these things. And one of the things that is not mentioned too often is the world policeman role, which I'm going to highlight in relation to the Central America interventions, because this is the this role that is captured in different ways. I'm going to mention three different ways. First, in the form of the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. This was a doctrine issued by Theodore Roosevelt in 1904. Which actually set out the United States as being the international policeman of the Western Hemisphere. Then I'm going to talk about the Truman Doctrine, which didn't explicitly state that, but in effect asserted the right of the United States to play this role. And then in the War on Terror today, which is a bit different. Actually, today it doesn't so much apply, doesn't really apply to Central America, but it's being taken elsewhere. As what Michael was saying, there's a kind of a basis established in United States relations with Central America and the Caribbean area that have been taken to a larger stage. This is pointed out also in Greg Grandin's book, Empire's Workshop. So I'll start here. The public criticism of the war on terrorism has mainly focused on its abusive practices rather than the underlying self-appointed world policeman role, which has been adopted by the United States. While it's absolutely necessary to challenge assassinations by armed drones and indefinite detentions, the larger policy must also be addressed, if only because it has served to justify these various kinds of abuses. The U.S. first announced its role as international policeman in the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine of 1904, applied to the Western Hemisphere. This doctrine was announced 1 year after the United States gained possession of the Panama Canal Zone, and 2 years after the United States officially ended its war in the Philippines, where the United States obtained the Philippines as a colony. The American public, unnerved by the cost and atrocities of the United States colonial war in the Philippines, at least the expansionists in the United States, shifted their focus to the Caribbean and Central America area. The Roosevelt Corollary declared that the United States had the right and responsibility as international policemen to intervene in nations of the Western Hemisphere so as to prevent chronic wrongdoing. It was, of course, a ruse because there was no international law to enforce. I'll have to drink some water here. Too much fire here. It was a ruse. There was no international law to enforce. It was the civilized, what Roosevelt thinking of the United States as a civilized nation, much like the imperial nations going of Europe going into Asia or Africa. It sent a message to the European nations that this area would be closed off to their influence, and it sent a message to the people of the region that their governments must accede to the United States' request and accommodate private United States business interests. The U.S. military interventions that ensued in Cuba, Nicaragua, Honduras, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, and Haiti over the next 30 years sparked rebellions, and in some cases, these rebellions led to the deaths of thousands of people. The United States intervention in Nicaragua from 1927 to 1933 was most important because it contributed to a shift in U.S. policy, and I'll mention a little bit about this particular one. The original purpose of the intervention was to quell fighting between the liberal and conservative factions and to organize new elections. But when liberal general Augusto Sandino refused to disarm, the occupation turned into a campaign to capture what they called the bandit Sandino. The intervention produced resentment across Latin America. At the Inter-American Conference in Havana in 1928, representatives from El Salvador introduced a resolution stating that no state may intervene in the affairs of another. The United States delegate promptly vetoed the measure. Within the United States, dissent was voiced by an eclectic mix of anti-imperialists, pacifists, progressives, socialists, a budding Communist Party, women's peace advocates, and about a dozen progressive senators. The Senate rejected two bills for the withdrawal of U.S. troops, but as the war dragged on, more bills were introduced. One actually prohibited the transfer of any more troops to the Nicaragua. So there was actually some progress through the democratic means from the movement that was in the United States. The Hoover administration withdrew all United States troops in January 1933, leaving in their place the U.S.-trained National Guard. The seven-year war cost the lives of an estimated 3,000 Nicaraguans and 136 U.S. Marines. In the aftermath, however, this war had a very negative public relations in Latin America, and the Roosevelt administration announced a different policy, the Good Neighbor Policy, a very simple policy, said we're not going to send U.S. Marines into Latin America. And so at that point, 1933, the Roosevelt corollary was rescinded effectively, and we adopted a non-interventionist foreign policy. So there was some success, some variation. So this is something to keep in mind, those of you who might be teaching history, that you can't put on United States history a single sort of motive, a single sort of continuum. There are variations across time and also space. The principle of non-intervention was also adopted in the United Nations Charter in 1945 and in the Charter of the Organization of American States in 1948. So hereafter, military intervention, unilateral military intervention by the United States is actually against international law. So we have another hurdle, and they have to be a little more subtle about it. The Truman Doctrine of 1947 established a new global policeman role for the United States and effectively negated all prohibitions against interventionism. Not that they stated that. President Harry Truman's immediate quest was in a speech before Congress in March 1947 was to obtain United States aid for the governments of Greece and Turkey. The Greek Civil War was framed as a contest between communist-led terrorists, and he used the word terrorist, and a government with the potential to become a self-respecting democracy. In fact, where the United States was supporting a royalist faction, which had outlawed political dissent, outlawed the Communist Party, but it was viewed as, or stated, framed as a potential for having self-respected democracy. He then extrapolated to the world at large and said this, quote, "The free peoples of the world look to us for support in maintaining their freedoms. If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of our own nation," end quote. This was a formula for unilateral interventionism and effectively sidelined the United Nations. The Truman Doctrine shined a spotlight on the Soviet Union's oppressive control over Eastern Europe and made no mention of the more extensive and long-standing oppression of Asian and African peoples by the America's allies in Europe. In early 1950, the Truman administration began aiding the French in their effort to recolonize Vietnam. It was an action, of course, that won no hearts and minds in the developing world. The U.S. also supported a host of repressive regimes and dictatorships in the name of anti-communism. And when repression failed, the newly formed CIA carried out interventions by stealth. Such was the case in Guatemala in 1954. The CIA organized, armed, and trained a rebel force that overthrew the democratically elected Arbenz government after it had nationalized land belonging to the U.S.-based United Fruit Company, and it had allowed the Communist Party to serve in the cabinet. A repressive rightist government was installed with full U.S. backing. Rebellion and more repression ensued. A long civil war took place, 36 years. In 1999, a report by the United Nations Historical Clarification Commission, this is a truth commission, placed the number of civilians killed or disappeared in the 36-year conflict at 200,000. I don't know if your statistics have that, and found that the military, police, and paramilitary forces under the government were responsible for 93% of human rights violations. This, by the way, there's a war crimes trial going on right now in Guatemala, and Rios Montt, who was formerly supported by the Reagan administration, is being tried on crimes against humanity and genocide for authorizing basically a scorched earth policy against the Mayan Indians. Cold War ideology reigned in the United States foreign policy for a generation, but came under duress in the 1970s after the Vietnam War, allowing for a mild shift toward progressive foreign policies and views. I won't go into those. We can talk about those if you want. In the mid-1970s, following revelations of the United States' involvement in the 1973 coup in Chile, Congress enacted laws prohibiting CIA assassinations, ending the CIA's secret involvement in Angola, and establishing human rights standards for U.S. foreign aid. President Jimmy Carter also secured a new Panama Canal Treaty, a symbolic return to the good neighbor policy. So in this very brief period, it was somewhat like an attempt to go back to the 1930s, but as it turns out, in 1980, we have a new president, Ronald Reagan, and he quickly seeks to return to this Manichaean Cold War ideology, unilateralism, and U.S. dominance in Central America and the Caribbean. The Reagan administration pushed aid to the repressive government of El Salvador and has sought to overthrow or undermine the Nicaraguan government, which had come into power in July 1979 through a popularly supported revolution. President Reagan, in justifying the new intervention in Central America, he basically mimicked Truman's famous speech of March 1947 in a nationally televised address to Congress in April 1983. He warned that unless the United States took action, Central America would be delivered to totalitarianism, followed by the destabilization of the entire region from the Panama Canal to Mexico on the southern border, on our southern border, and we ourselves are left vulnerable to new dangers. Typical of this administration's hegemonic thinking was an internal strategy paper of March 1984 that declared the United States would not allow, quote, any foreign-inspired and supported insurgency in Central America, end quote, as if the United States' support for the Contra insurgency was not exactly that. So the United States understood itself, we are not foreigners. That is our backyard. We're not the foreigners. The domestic opponents of Reagan's policies in Central America, of which there were many, challenged this Orwellian framing with facts on the ground and also a grassroots mobilization. It's a book that I wrote about, the Anti-Contra War Campaign. The message reached some in Washington, including former CIA director Stansfield Turner. In April 1985, he told a congressional committee, quote, there are many of us today who see the actions of the Contras as being beneath the ethical standards we would like the United States to employ. And specifically, I believe it is irrefutable that a number of the Contras' actions have to be characterized as terrorism, as state-supported terrorism. So here we have a former CIA director, because he's embarrassed by what's going on, the bad reputation being attached to the CIA, he's saying that these are state-supported terrorists. And this is, of course, was exactly what the United States was supposed to be fighting. Internationally, Latin American leaders initiated the Contador peace process as an alternative to Reagan's war policy. European leaders and allies also quietly urged the Reagan administration to desist. They continued to aid Nicaragua while the United States was trying to convince them not to, humanitarian aid. The Nicaraguan government brought suit against the United States in the International Court of Justice, or World Court, following the mining of Nicaraguan harbors by the CIA in April 1984. The Reagan administration refused to recognize the jurisdiction of the court in the matter, but nonetheless attempted to defend itself in the court of public opinion by arguing that its actions were consistent with the principle of collective defense, alleging that Nicaraguan arms transfers to Salvadoran rebels allowed the United States to intervene. The court ruled against the United States in June 1986, stating that, quote, the evidence is insufficient to satisfy the court that the government of Nicaragua was responsible for any flow of arms, end quote. The court declared that by training, arming, equipping, financing, and supplying the Contra forces, or otherwise encouraging, supporting, and aiding military and paramilitary activities in and against Nicaragua, that the United States was acting in breach of its obligation under customary international law not to intervene in the affairs of another state. Now, the United States, as a great power, simply ignored the order. And the Reagan administration disregarded that and prevented the UN Security Council from enforcing it. The current war on terrorism continues this U.S. tendency to take the law into its own hands. In response to the September 11, 2001 terrorist attack on U.S. soil, the George W. Bush administration undertook two wars, toppling governments in Afghanistan and Iraq, in an apparent attempt to apprehend stateless terrorist al-Qaeda terrorists. That the Taliban had no interest in attacking the United States, and that the regime of Saddam Hussein had neither chemical weapons nor ties to al-Qaeda was immaterial to the quest to reassert U.S. global influence and sustain the so-called American century. The United Nations weapons inspection team, led by Hans Blix, had in fact done a thorough job of dismantling plants capable of producing weapons of mass destruction. But the United States, through misleading intelligence, claimed otherwise. In other words, what I'm saying here is that the UN actually had developed a pretty good system for dealing with an international terrorist threat, all right? That Saddam Hussein had actually used weapons, chemical weapons. I'm sure you're aware of this history of in the Iran-Iraq war, in which the United States was looked the other way, had no interest, but now was using this as justification for intervention. Nonetheless, the United Nations was fairly effective. The National Security Strategy Report of 2002 under the Bush administration asserted that the United States had the right to act against such emerging threats before they are fully formed. This is, again, there's no basis in international law for acting against an emerging threat before you can even acknowledge it, and for the United States alone to do this. Acting in accordance with this distorted conception of a world policeman, the United States has employed indefinite detention, torture, and aerial assassinations of people suspected of being terrorists. And it has extended its counterterrorism operations to nations with which the United States is not at war. For people living in the remote tribal areas in Pakistan or Yemen, the war on terrorism has become a war of terrorism, a war of terror, as the United States armed drones hover above waiting to strike. Former President Jimmy Carter, in an op-ed article in the New York Times, June 24, 2012, charged that the United States assassinations and indefinite detentions violate human rights principles set forth in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the United Nations. Quote, it is disturbing, he wrote, that instead of strengthening these principles, our government's counterterrorism policies are now clearly violating at least 10 of the Declaration's 30 articles, including the prohibition against cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment, end quote. In January of this year, the United Nations opened a major new investigation into the use of U.S. drones, use of drones, and targeted assassinations. I'll conclude by noting a few counter-indications to this self-appointed U.S. policeman role, perhaps some hopeful indications. First, there's been a fundamental shift in the world order since World War II, evident in the demise of European imperialism and the rise of human and civil rights. The idea of great power domination is being challenged by a set of new international norms. There's much to say about that, but let's go on. Number two, respect for international law and institutions has grown, albeit more in Europe than the United States. Ending unilateral militarism of any nation will arguably require greater reliance on and empowerment of institutions such as the United Nations and the International Criminal Court. And three, truth commissions and war crimes trials in Guatemala, Argentina, Chile, and elsewhere have revealed the dark side of American-backed regimes during the Cold War. Lessons have been learned and may yet be applied to the present. And, of course, there are many historians, writers, educators, journalists who are intent on making these lessons known to the American citizens and students, and this conference is an example of that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Roger. Originally, there were three panelists scheduled for this meeting, and the one who was going to come second was going to cover Afghanistan, and he was going to compare the British invasion in Afghanistan or involvement in Afghanistan in 1919, which was actually the third one that the British had engaged in about a century, with the American intervention in the 1980s and since then. And I thought that it's too bad that person had to drop out because it would have provided a bridge between Roger, who also starts way back in the first part of the century with the Roosevelt corollary, who's going to have the British acting as imperialists in Afghanistan in 1919, but then bringing it right up to the current time where the United States has taken over from the British, we're fighting a very current war today in Afghanistan, and that was going to be the transition to the paper on Yemen, which is a country the United States just discovered probably around 1999, 2000 with the blowing up of the USS Cole. But Yemen is one of those countries that you mentioned came into being after World War II with this shift in world order from about, I think it was 50-some-odd states founded the UN in 1945, and today we have 192. And at one point, we even had two Yemens. We had South Yemen and we had Yemen, and they were among the 100-odd new countries which emerged after World War II. Now they're together again. The paper that Nathan is going to talk about, intervention in Yemen, also comes in two parts. There was a Yemen war in the 1960s, and the intervener was more Egypt. The United States was not involved there, unless, you see, at the time, the United States was backing both Egypt and later in the war, Saudi Arabia, were the countries that actually intervened in the Yemen war in the 60s. But in the Yemen war in the 21st century, it's all the United States all the time. So that's what Nathan Christensen is going to report on, intervention in the Yemen wars. And I think I kind of urged him, you know, not to spend too much time on the 60s war because the U.S. isn't there very much, although it is in the background, but particularly in the 21st century, this is one of the big ones, and heard a lot about drones here today, and one of the places where we're dropping those drones or shooting those drones, whatever you do with them, is definitely Yemen. So,
sure, thank you for a great introduction. I want to focus on that specifically, you know, speaking of drones, on some of the name of our conference, The New Faces of American Intervention Abroad, alongside the old. Something that Roger is getting at, that there are precedents to what the United States is doing abroad in places today, even like South America and Honduras and Mexico, as early as the 2000s and Venezuela and Haiti, but certainly in the Arab world as well, in places like Yemen. So you have to forgive me if I read a little bit more than project. This is my first real big public speaking opportunity, so I'll try and engage at the same time. On January 14th of this year, 2013, just a week before his inauguration, President Obama did something that a U.S. president rarely does, hosting not a fellow head of state, but rather Saudi Arabia's Minister of Interior, Prince Mohammed bin Naif bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, in the Oval Office to discuss U.S. policy in the Arabian Gulf. And to affirm, quote, the strong partnership between the United States and Saudi Arabia. A week later, on Obama's inauguration day and immediately thereafter, Hellfire missiles, fired from U.S. drones over the course of 3 days, slammed into the rural province of Madib in central Yemen, allegedly killing a handful of al-Qaeda militants, their bodies too charred afterwards to confirm otherwise. What the events surrounding Obama's inauguration, for me at least, throw into stark relief, and what I want to prompt us to think about in today's presentation, as I mentioned a second ago, are both the new faces of the U.S. war, U.S. intervention, as this conference is titled, as well as the old. And what follows, as Michael mentioned, I will briefly talk about Yemen's 1962 civil war to highlight the fact that much of modern Yemeni politics were forged, as it were, in the blood and fire of foreign military intervention. The authoritarian, tribally dominated regime that came to power after 1970, the year the civil war ended, and the series of pro-Saudi military governments that have ruled Yemen up until the present day are a direct result of military intervention in Yemen carried out in the name of countering communist influence in the Arab world, one of the old faces of war. But in the post-9/11 world of the war on terror, communism has been replaced by just that, terrorism, as the object of intervention for endless drone warfare, and Yemen has once again become the site of foreign intervention on a massive scale. I'll spend the larger part of my presentation tracing the history of U.S. intervention in Yemen, highlighting the global arms trade in the Gulf, America's support for the Gulf monarchies, and the role of direct U.S. intervention in Yemen as key to understanding U.S. imperialism, and I think the important part that hopefully we can discuss after the presentation, and also in developing strategies of resistance, both to the older faces of war and the new. So to begin with the civil war, at once a civil war between local Republican and Royalist forces and a front in the Cold War that saw Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Britain, and the Soviet Union intervene in South Arabia and apparently Israel as well. North Yemen's 1962 to 1970 civil war had a deep impact on both Yemen and the region. On September 26, 1967, a group of junior army officers, many of them self-proclaimed Nasserists, following the sort of third worldist trend of the time, very much headed by President Abdel Nasser in Egypt and by Nehru in India, staged a coup against the ruling Imamate in Yemen. Officers surrounded the royal palace and shelled it with tanks, claiming to have killed Imam al-Badr and announcing the formation of the Yemen Arab Republic. In fact, Imam al-Badr was not killed. He escaped to the mountains and rallied those tribes loyal to the Imamate to wage war with Saudi, Jordanian, and British backing against the new republic. Egyptian soldiers arrived in Yemen immediately after the coup, with troop levels reaching 60 to 70,000 by 1965. I think I mentioned on January 26, 1967, but I meant 1962, just to make that quick correction. It was deliberate Egyptian policy to undermine a central independent republic in the north by funding northern tribes over a unified North Yemeni state. Strengthening tribal sheikhs within the hierarchy of the tribal system while simultaneously undermining the formation of a central government or a central army in North Yemen. It was just these tribal sheikhs who were often only nominally allied with the Republican forces for no other reason than to procure arms and cash, who pushed for and benefited from the eventual Saudi-backed, and I think that's the important part that resonates today as well, from the eventual Saudi-backed peace deal in 1970, which established, surprisingly enough, a pro-Saudi, tribally dominated conservative regime in North Yemen. Saudi Arabia has dominated Yemeni politics and economic development since the war, the war's end in 1970, and its role was greatly increased through its relationship with the northern tribes as provider of guns and money. In all negotiations throughout the war, Egypt and Saudi Arabia excluded the Yemenis from the negotiating table, a practice quite reminiscent of the recent Gulf Cooperation Council initiative that saw Saudi Arabia and the United States negotiate an end to Yemen's democratic uprisings over the past 2 to 3 years. In 1970 as well, it was Saudi Arabia that would dictate the terms of peace after Egypt's 1967 departure from Yemen. With the Saudis having successfully de-revolutionized the republic, they continued after 1970 to provide subsidies to the northern tribes in the amount of $60 to $80 million per year, and also began providing massive foreign aid to the nascent Yemen Arab Republic. The strong state of northern tribes in Yemen's post-war government and its inability to raise revenue through taxes throughout the country, thus significantly increased Saudi Arabia's influence within the government and within the tribal structure, for which it was and still is the main source of revenue. As for the Americans' part, in 1963, Egyptian bombing of royalist strongholds in Saudi Arabia and internal dissent within Saudi's military ranks themselves led the Kennedy administration to carry out Operation Hard Surface, sending U.S. planes and warships to support the kingdom. After President Kennedy's death, the Lyndon Johnson administration was most interested to continue pursuing plans for the long-term support of the Saudi monarchy. In 1965, the U.S. authorized an agreement with the Corps of Engineers to provide the construction of military facilities in the kingdom, and in 1966, it sponsored a $100 million program which provided the Saudi forces with combat vehicles. This is not to imply that, for any reason, the American funding, first for Egypt, which I don't really go into, but the Kennedy administration also backed through food aid Egypt during the time that they were intervening in Yemen, or for Saudi Arabia, necessarily drove the war, but to highlight what was the beginning of a long-term U.S. relationship with Yemen, primarily defined by the militarized logic of providing for the security of oil-rich Gulf monarchies, no matter the cost to Yemeni society. Thus, the Civil War had the effect, A, of grounding Yemen in a dependent relationship with Saudi Arabia, and B, saw the beginning of massive arms deals in the Gulf, and furthermore, the establishment of a series of military regimes that have ruled Yemen up until today. Keeping the effects of the 1962 war sort of in our view, I will spend the rest of my paper discussing the post-9/11 War on Terror, as it's called, in Yemen, carried out by direct U.S. military intervention and by proxy through Saudi Arabia, who's waging their own war on terror in Yemen as well as through massive military funding by the United States and Saudi Arabia for so-called security initiatives in Yemen. Massive arms deals between the UK, US, and Saudi Arabia began in earnest during and in the wake of the Yemen Civil War, the North Yemen Civil War, having continued unabated since. With the closure of British bases throughout the Gulf during the 1970s, the United States began to step up its military commitments to the region. In his 1980 State of the Union address, President Jimmy Carter assured Soviet forces in Afghanistan, where they had recently invaded, that, quote, "an attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." Language, if anyone's familiar with the Gulf War from the early 90s, that resonated in that that UN resolution passed to repel Saudi, Saddam Hussein from Kuwait as well by any means necessary. In that sense, and the ones I'm about to talk about, Carter's vision has continued to guide U.S. strategists long since the Soviet Union's fall, with the United States pursuing regional security and protecting American-friendly oil producers through the massive militarization of the Persian Gulf. Between 1976 and 2007, the total cost of maintaining the U.S. military in the Persian Gulf has been estimated at about $7 trillion, and that's not including what has recently been spent on the 2003 Iraq War. The U.S. military has, in fact, used its withdrawal from Iraq to further strengthen its relationship with the Gulf monarchies, stationing 15,000 troops in Kuwait and pushing for more naval and air patrols of the region. Despite congressional opposition, the Obama administration continues to sell weapons to Bahrain throughout its own domestic uprisings over the past 2 years. Since the beginning of 2012, the United States has positioned the USS Ponce, a large floating base in the Gulf, moved a squadron of F-22 fighters to the United Arab Emirates, doubled its minesweeping presence, and deployed the Sea Fox undersea drone to ensure Iran cannot mine the Strait of Hormuz, something that they have threatened to do if the United States continues its bellicose foreign policy in the region. Most importantly for this presentation, in late 2011, the United States announced an agreement to sell 84 F-15 fighter jets valued at nearly $30 billion to the Royal Saudi Air Force, continuing an approach to regional commerce and the war on terror consistent with 60 years of U.S. foreign policy. Which brings us to Yemen. The United States since the 1970s, as I've said, is driven to militarize the Gulf in order to protect oil, oil producers, and the flow of oil. Increasingly, the rhetoric and practice surrounding such protection is focused on checking the perceived rise of a troublesome Iran, but also on shoring up the Gulf regimes against domestic and regional opposition, including in Yemen. Although Saudi Arabia's support in suppressing popular uprisings in Bahrain through direct military intervention has been well covered by U.S. media, for the most part, journalists and even anti-war activists in this country have been quite slow to criticize the kingdom's role in Yemen, and by extension, the United States. After sitting on a story for close to 2 years due to so-called security concerns, the New York Times and Washington Post this year finally revealed the presence of that secret military base, that secret drone base that's been used to carry out drone attacks in Yemen, which happens to be Saudi Arabia, from which the United States deployed drones to assassinate targets in Yemen, including American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki. In North Yemen, where the Saudis wreaked havoc in 1962 to make sure a revolutionary regime did not emerge in the Arabian Gulf, the kingdom now sees an Iranian hand, rather than an Egyptian one, trying to threaten their status quo. Despite a serious lack of evidence, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have been keen to push the claim that Iran is supporting Shiite rebels, Houthi rebels, in Yemen's north, a region that has been in rebellion against the capital Sana'a since 2004. The sectarian card, played alongside the specter of terrorism and an Iranian threat, has been a useful tool in expanding U.S. and Saudi hegemony into Yemen. WikiLeaks releases of U.S. embassy cables reveal that U.S. arms deals with Yemen under former President Ali Abdullah Saleh fueled the 2004 to 2011 war against the Houthi rebels, aiding the government in massive attacks on densely populated civilian areas during Yemen's aptly named Operation Scorched Earth, attacks that U.S.-provided Saudi bombers also participated in. This aptly named operation did exactly as advertised, indiscriminately bombing the civilian infrastructure of Sada, a key city economically and historically in Yemen's north, and laying waste to the region's vibrant agricultural economy, displacing in the process thousands of Yemenis and making Yemen one of the countries with the largest internally displaced people's populations in the world at around 500,000. Which a problem that has been exacerbated in the recent Abyan war against al-Qaeda affiliated groups that expanded their presence in South Yemen as Yemeni forces loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh withdrew from strategic areas in the south to protect his falling regime against a rising protest movement in the capital. The final push of this war was backed by U.S. drone strikes as well as Saudi bombing runs. This direct American intervention in the form of drone strikes, what we might call the U.S.-led dirty war in Yemen, has been ongoing actually since 2001. Having lost virtually all aid, U.S. aid by voting no to the U.N. Security Council resolution authorizing any means necessary, the use of force, to remove Saddam Hussein's forces from Kuwait in 1990, former President Saleh was quick to announce Yemen's support for the U.S.-led war on terror in the aftermath of 9/11. The U.S. in turn was quick to renew its foreign aid to Yemen to push Saleh to crack down on al-Qaeda cells in the country. At America's behest, Ali Abdullah Saleh threw hundreds of mostly innocent Yemenis into overcrowded jails where they were kept without charge, in solitary confinement, and tortured. As you all know, a tried and true tactic of the war on terror, from Abu Ghraib to Guantanamo Bay, from CIA black sites to the occupied Palestinian territories and beyond. The United States' first drone strike was launched in November 2002 against suspects of the 2000 USS Cole bombing that Michael mentioned in Aden. Most strikes, however, have been carried out in the past few years, since about 2009. At the end of 2009, Obama authorized a cruise missile strike that left at least 20 children, a dozen women dead in the southern town of Al-Majalla, along with one militant, a strike that would undoubtedly prove a major propaganda boon for al-Qaeda's recruiting efforts in Yemen. In May of 2010, a U.S. drone strike intended to kill an al-Qaeda operative in Madib province instead killed one of his distant relatives, ironically the deputy governor of that province, tasked with negotiating the peaceful surrender of Islamist militants in the region. Later in October 2011, as I'm sure most of us know, this is the only real drone strike on Yemen that tends to make it into the American press, the American-born Anwar al-Awlaki, a preacher suspected, and I really think we should insist on that, suspected, of inspiring the perpetrator of the Fort Hood shootings and the failed crotch bombing aboard a Detroit-bound commercial airliner at Christmas 2009, was killed. Weeks later, so was his teenage son in a strike on a public open-air restaurant in Yemen's south, shredding what was left of the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution in the process. As of today, there are few, if any, rules in the Yemeni theater of operations in the U.S.-led war on terror, with, as many of you know, signature drone strikes authorizing suspicious patterns of behavior as probable cause for drone strikes throughout the country, strikes that in any real sense do not distinguish between fighters, who are few in the country, increasingly many as the drone strikes continue, distinguishing them from yet women, children, and especially not men of fighting age. Only a handful of high-profile al-Qaeda operatives have been successfully eliminated in Yemen. For the most part, many nameless armed men, assorted family members, and innocent civilians have been those liquidated by U.S. Hellfire missiles. The vast majority of the 50 recorded airstrikes last year in Yemen were launched by the Americans, including a September 2nd strike near the town of Rada that killed 3 children and 9 other civilians. In Yemen's south and around towns such as Rada, the one I just mentioned, the maddening overhead buzz of drones is a persistent token of American surveillance, rupturing the fabric of Yemeni society in more ways than simply through death and physical injury, as a recent study by NYU and Stanford Law on drone warfare in Pakistan highlighted. Yet despite its intensifying involvement in Yemen, the United States has not formulated a genuinely diplomatic mission in that country. Instead, choosing to keep Saudi dominance of the region while pursuing what has become known as the AFPAC strategy of endless drone warfare in Yemen. Current U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Gerald Feuerstein, was tapped more for his counterterrorism credentials than his vast diplomatic experience. During the protracted negotiations under the Saudi-led initiative of the Gulf Cooperation Council to facilitate a transition from the rule of Saleh to the president to the presidency of his deputy, Abdurrabbu Mansour al-Hadi, Washington's envoy was the current director of the CIA, John Brennan, rather than somebody with a State Department pedigree or, for instance, with Hillary Clinton's ear. Rather than providing systematic humanitarian aid and support for civil society initiatives, American measures in Yemen include providing Sana'a with light aircraft, armed vehicles, gadgetry, and training, direct military cooperation with and command and control backing for Yemeni forces, cheerleading for the new president's restructuring of Yemen's military command and the establishment of what many have called a new green zone in the capital, comprised of the highly militarized U.S. embassy, as they are across the world, and the recently acquired Sheraton Hotel as a fortified extension to accommodate American consultants and experts, as was the case in Iraq, a major step towards a full-fledged U.S. imperial presence in Yemen.
Could I ask you to hold, I know you're getting to the last section, could we hold that till the exchange, you can maybe summarize your conclusion then?
Sure.
Because you've got all of it except his concluding remarks, and I wanted to stop the speech after about 20 minutes. Okay, I'm going to just make a few remarks, then I'll throw it out to you. We've got 45 minutes left. You can get your conclusion in if we have to, or we can have some questions. But I just wanted to make one or two remarks from that I had on the basis of these two papers. And I'll go back to the first one for those of you that came in late, the one about Latin America. There's one or two things I wanted to say about that. And I want to use one or two more of my my tables, which some of you are holding there. I wanted to put up here this table number 4, which talks about the people that we deal with and how we sometimes have to give them names like thugs and crazy people. Because you mentioned Rios Montt, and we mentioned Pinochet, and we mentioned Somoza. And so what I did with the 34 cases that I studied was that I characterized some of these people as either collaborators with us, some of them as CIA assets, some of them are drug traffickers, and many of them are dictators. And then I had two categories of them, thugs and pests, and the different names that we call these people before trying to discredit them. There is one other thing that I wanted to mention about Jimmy Carter, who comes across pretty well in Roger's telling, and I agree that he is I have a chapter in my book in which it's called The Aberration, that Jimmy Carter is an aberration, and he's the only one that did not invade, or there's no intervention case associated with Jimmy Carter. And he actually did try to go back to the good neighbor, in effect, but the point of my book is how difficult he found this to do. I sent a copy to the Carter Library, a little note to Jimmy Carter, and said, please don't be put off by the title of your chapter calling you the aberration. I mean, that's taken in a good sense. You're the only one who tried not to engage in this hegemonic behavior, which reminds me of another thing I wanted to mention about your paper. I don't like the use of the word role policeman. I prefer, as I say in my book, I call it, the original title of this book was Rise of the Global Hegemon, American Foreign Policy in the Periphery. And the publisher said, the average person cannot understand any of those words, hegemon, periphery, what are you talking about? Let's call this American adventurism abroad. That's so much easier, and I really appreciate that. But I still like the word hegemon. And in class, I try to describe American behavior as imperial. That really puts the students off. No, you sound like a communist calling American foreign policy imperialistic and so on. So I can't say imperialism. And the world policeman, I kind of associate that with the Korean War. I mean, we're really not out there trying to police and maintain good behavior. We're really out there trying to control. And this is the word what hegemony means, hegemony. It's control, it's influence. Unlike imperialism, it does imply a little bit of collaboration on the part of the recipient. And that gets into this Saudi Arabia thing with Yemen, that the Saudi Arabia, we had a little exchange before today about whether Saudi Arabia was a client of the United States or a co-participant, collaborator with the United States. And I would say they're both hegemons in Yemen. And of course, Saudi Arabia is the regional hegemon, has always been running Yemen, but the United States kind of uses Saudi Arabia, and we get our way out of what we want in Yemen too. So one final thing, and then I'll throw it open. You mentioned how the United States, you talk about Truman in Roger's case, the Truman Doctrine. I have a little section in my Truman Doctrine. And as you put correctly, and as everybody repeats, the United States began after World War II by citing the Civil War in Greece, and therefore we came up with this elaborate military aid program to Greece and Turkey. Where did that come from? Turkey. There's no civil war going on in Turkey. There's no threat by the Soviet Union to anything going on in Turkey. But this was an example of our power projection, getting our hegemony into that part of the world, which had previously been an area for British hegemony. And the United States goes over there, takes advantage of the civil war, which was indeed going on in Greece, to establish the bases we have in Turkey to this day. And Turkey's bases which we're able to use right up until Turkey, someone mentioned in a panel this morning, became democratic in the 21st century, and they refused to let us use those bases to enter into Iraq in 2003. But the point that I wanted to make here, this is another one of my five tables, table two, that in every one of these instances of the United States going into one of these places, except throughout the Western Hemisphere, all the other places, we're replacing Britain, or France, or Italy, or Portugal, well, I guess Italy in the case of Somalia and Libya. We talk in terms of the East-West struggle, and we're out there fighting communism, but what we're really doing is replacing the previous hegemonic or imperial, if you will, powers. And I got the list of the imperial powers that we're replacing, even the Netherlands and Indonesia, for example. So I think those were the main points that I wanted to make. Oh, there was one other one here that I thought was worth mentioning. Another way, I really liked your paper, Roger, except for the two words. One was the policeman, which I would prefer, hegemony, and the other one was the preemptive war that you buy into the official explanation of why we had to go into Iraq in 2003. Everyone said it was a preemptive war before they used their weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't preemptive at all. Preemptive means these people are imminently about to strike. This was more of a preventive war that, someday in the distant future they might strike somebody. And that's definitely against international law, which I know you had a lot of concern about in your paper. You did that part on the international law well, but you know, there's even more breaking of international law when you engage in a preventive war as opposed to a preemptive war, which is sometimes acceptable under international law. Okay, I guess that's about all that I wanted to say. Now I would throw it open to any of you. You want to talk to me or talk to Nathan? Or, yeah.
Can you finish your paper?
Yeah, okay. We can go back. Yeah, all right. I wanted to just take a break.
Sure.
Then. Yeah, that's a good idea. He had about a page left of conclusion. Why don't we get back to that?
Uh-huh. I can get right to the import. I mean, I don't think that it's really worth coming together and studying U.S. And I'm okay with the term imperialism. With U.S. imperialism abroad, if we don't also talk about strategies for resisting that. You know, we are activists. I'd like to consider myself an activist first and foremost, and my scholarship is informing that. So I'd like to ask the question, you know, I don't know how many people were at Rashid Khalidi's talk earlier when he talked about the role of Saudi Arabia as a counter-revolutionary force in the Arab world. So, you know, in the context of Yemen, certainly, but also in places like Palestine, how do we counter these older faces of U.S. policy, you know, 60 years of policy in the Gulf, you know, a long-standing policy with Latin America that I think continues until today, along with the new faces of drone warfare. So this is something that I was hoping that we could possibly engage in discussion. I don't have all the answers. You know, as someone only located on a university campus in New York, you know, my sort of activist trajectory tends to be university-focused. So I thought it'd be interesting to bring up, let's see here where this is in my paper, that unfortunately, while a vibrant anti-war movement while a vibrant anti-war movement has unfortunately been lacking in the U.S. for some time, other opponents of U.S. militarism abroad, such as Students for Justice in Palestine, have flourished. I believe a resurgent anti-war movement could build on the important activist networks already established by Students for Justice in Palestine chapters across the country, and engage SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, the SJP movement, in a broader critique of U.S. imperialism. After all, the growing importance of Saudi capital in Palestine has also gone a long way towards helping demobilize a formerly vibrant national resistance movement there as well. Finally, I also think it's important to question the centrality of oil to the U.S. economy, as historian Toby Jones contends, to recognize the ways oil and oil producers have long been militarized, and to recognize the role oil has played in regional confrontation in the Gulf for almost four decades. Recent efforts by the environmental activist group 350.org, I don't know if people are familiar with them, to bring U.S. universities, cities, states, and other institutions to divest from fossil fuel companies, I think should be fertile grounds for anti-war activists to organize around, considering the obvious connections between environmental degradation, the oil-based economy, and endless warfare. Finally, you know, that's for the older side of warfare. As for the new, which for the most part in the context of Yemen takes the form of drone warfare, there's a panel tomorrow, I know, at 9 a.m., a bunch of people organizing here in the Baltimore area, specifically with Hopkins, John Hopkins University, in trying to get, I think the panel is called The Politics of Drone Warfare in the University. I have a couple of guys sitting up here that certainly can tell you all about it after the panel, hopefully. That I think promises to ask serious questions about how U.S. activists such as ourselves can combat the new faces of U.S. intervention and the proliferation of drone warfare technology. So hopefully see everybody tomorrow. Thank you for listening to my presentation.
Okay. I'm glad that question got you to the oil. I meant to, that was a very important part of your paper, the oil, which brings me back to my favorite topic, of course, of hegemony. And this is what this deal that we made with Saudi Arabia going back to 1945, the oil for security. You keep the oil flowing, we will provide you, King of Saudi Arabia, with security. In that case, it's security against mainly your own people, particularly the Shiites who are in the oil areas of Saudi Arabia. But also, you pointed out in your paper, that a couple of these wars were proxy wars, in which in one case, We're helping Saudi Arabia against Egypt, which was coming at it from the left in the 1960s, but now we're helping Saudi Arabia against Iran, which is coming at it from the right and backing those Houthis in the 21st century.
Supposedly, but,
yeah. Right. And the point is whether the threat to the king of Saudi Arabia is from the left or from the right, the United States is going to stick with that king because of that deal we made in 1945. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to comment even before you brought it up on the Carter aberration, because I've always thought that was a really interesting little period in the history of U.S. imperialism, since and imperialism and colonialism globally, since there were all kinds of imperialist wars and conflicts that still took place. And the funny thing about Turner, it's like, okay, so there's this guy Turner who says that aiding the Contras is actually like assisting terrorism. Where'd this guy come from, and how do you get to be the head of the CIA? He wasn't welcome at all as the head of the CIA. And in fact, after Carter appointed him, there was basically a rebellion within the CIA where you had a whole establishment of people who some people actually called the second CIA, who operated autonomously on the international scene and worked with like French, Egyptian, Moroccan, Saudi Arabian, and pre-revolutionary Iranian intelligence agencies to orchestrate interventions in Zaire and Somalia, Ethiopia during that period. And the U.S. shadow CIA was complicit in that, even though Carter and Turner were actually, it seemed like they were good guys basically trying to like cut down on this whole thing. So to me, what that says is that the like network of imperialist powers that maintain, you know, control over the mines, control over the oil, and use violence to do that are more powerful than actually state-based actors like the President of the United States and the Director of the CIA, and that those actors will maintain their economic interests even ahead of the realist interests of the states involved. Also true in the Guatemala 54 case, where a lot of people say the United Fruit connection was actually through the CIA head Dulles, Alan Dulles, where he was actually a major shareholder in United Fruit himself. So like arguably that could be seen as just his economic interest, like no even participation from the Department of Defense required. So I just wanted to kind of present that as like one framework for looking at these things.
I think we need to mention East Timor as on Jimmy Carter's watch as well, and the genocide that happened there.
That was fought though.
In East Timor?
Yeah.
Wasn't that East Timor during President Carter's reign?
I got that one up there.
Did not he support the Indonesian regime during?
No, 1975. It was fought in Kissinger, because Kissinger remember that.
Oh, well, let me just comment. Thanks for that information. The institution, once these powers, you know, you get a committee like committee on the present danger, a movement group, right? But they're high-level people. Once they get in power, they're not going to want to let it go. So whether it's the CIA or whether it's in the administration. So you have the Iran-Contra scandal, right, in the Reagan administration. Why is that? Because these people were ordered by Congress to stop the Contra aid, and they didn't want to. So Ollie North's working in the basement of the White House to do this. So, you know, I think they can do this over a period of time. Had we really established or reestablished a good neighbor policy, I think over a period of time, those people would have been, could have been, you know, exited out. But I think there's going to be people in who are going to want to hold on in any institution. So, yeah.
That was also about the time of the Team B. Were you talking about the alternative CIA? Were you referring to the Team B, which they actually created another whole group of people in the CIA because they didn't like the intelligence they were getting from the establishment CIA on the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union military buildup? They wanted it to be more, so they had two teams working in the CIA, the official one and then the Team B, which came up with greater Soviet military buildup.
Mm. Great question.
Yes.
I have a question. I don't do American history, so I don't know sort of the president's stuff, so this may come off as not a very good question, but I'm kind of curious. You mentioned Carter as a aberration in this kind of nasty, I don't know what to call that. I'm wondering why. I mean, in the sense, I'm sure it's not because he was a nice guy, right? I mean, Obama's a nice guy. Obama read Richard the Earth and, like, smoked marijuana, and it's kind of, you know, but when he comes into power, things change, and he's launching Hellfire missiles into Yemen and all over the place. So I'm kind of curious, what structurally was happening? You know, why was it that Carter was able to
Well, it was the post-Vietnam era, and he was reacting against 8 years of, 16 years, 8 years of Johnson and 8 years of Nixon-Ford administration, and there was a backlash against that. And he ran for office saying, "I will not tell you a lie, and no Americans will die in combat under my watch." And there is, I don't know if you got that from his Christianity, he was a Sunday school teacher and all too, so he was not a pacifist by any means, a nuclear submarine commander and so on. And then he does go out in a blaze of glory in 1980 with this Carter Doctrine that was referred to, I guess, in your paper. When the Soviets go into Afghanistan in 1980, Carter announces this doctrine that we will protect the resources of the Persian Gulf with whatever means necessary, you know, implying nuclear means, even though Afghanistan is not very close to the Persian Gulf that he's talking about. But every war since then, they've cited the Carter Doctrine, the 1991 war, they cite the Carter Doctrine, the 2003 war, they cited the Republican presidents are citing the Carter Doctrine. So the Carter, the post-Vietnam era that he ran for president in 1976, lasted about 2.5 years. And it was marked also by the tension he had between Vance and Brzezinski, Vance in the State Department, Brzezinski in the White House. And, you know, I think he was trying to, you know, make some kind of a synthesis there of different strains of American politics. And he had to get rid of Vance after the attempted rescue of the hostages in Iran, in which people did die, but Carter would maintain not in combat. They were only on a rescue mission. There were people died in that military action in Iran. But at that point, Vance resigned from the State Department because he was against it. Carter was unable to keep even the straddle, let alone, I mean, he always had Brzezinski with him there telling him to watch out for the Soviet Union. But he did have Vance, and who also had been seared by the Vietnam War experience. He was Secretary of the Army during the Vietnam War. He puts Cyrus Vance in as Secretary of State. And he was trying to, you know, restore some balance to American ideals with these wars that we have been in since 1945.
Yeah, let me add a couple of things, because you're asking why. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, in addition to the Vietnam War, you know, had a disturbing effect. There's, you know, part of the population think it is immoral, partly from the conduct of it, that the killing by bombing, the lots of civilians, My Lai, various other things. Nick Turskin is his new book bringing out now, but also because of the purpose, you know, seen as unnecessary halfway around the world. People look in the history, see the 1954. Geneva Convention and so forth. So that is weighing on people. Then you also had the Watergate scandal undermined the sense of, you know, there's this question, this sort of identity crisis in America. And Carter comes in as he's a good guy. He's a Christian. He has a folksy way. He's Honest Abe. And he comes in, he's going to clean up government. He didn't come in with a foreign policy agenda. He's going to clean up government. But part of things that are going on, really, is the Congress that's pushing human rights, for example, before he gets there. Congress is pushing human rights, and that's because the Church Committee, there's an investigation over a year long, the Church Committee, Senator Frank Church, investigating the CIA's role in the Chile, in the overthrow of the Allende government. And, you know, and this comes out. You know, there's shown ahead that the CIA has been trying to assassinate Castro and other leaders and so forth. It has. And so there's a whole range of things that starts weighing in that this may be a time, you know, to be a little more humble. There's a kind of more humble attitude. Of course, this is what Reagan totally rejects. Now, to say about Carter aberration is to see it very limited. Now, Carter was sort of riding the political wave, because Carter, when he came out, he gives a speech about Iran, about the Shah of Iran. He is our ally. Say anything about human rights. Carter initiated the support for the Mujahideen before the Soviets were invited in by the Afghan government. The United States created the problem in Afghanistan by sending arms, and Brzezinski later admitted this about 15 years later. So, but just to say, there is this sort of humbling point in which this opportunities and people. Progressives, human rights lobbies expanded. Human rights, Amnesty International, I guess the Nobel Peace Prize. There's a major lobby. He's talking about the Palestinian group now. These can have a real effect. And in the 70s, the human rights lobby came up. So there's some reasons. And the one other I should mention comes from a real politic change, which is the détente. Now, détente was instituted by Nixon as a sort of pragmatic. And yeah, we're going to ally with, a little bit more with China to prevent Soviet Union and so forth. Well, all that, but to the public, which has been indoctrinated with 25 years of the communist bad, there's no such thing as peaceful coexistence. Well, all of a sudden we can live with them. Our Republican conservative president says, yeah, peaceful coexistence is possible. So why be in Vietnam? Why even fight communisms, you know? So if you can live with them, if you might compete. So all these things kind of, I think, have a culminating effect in pushing to a degree, but it wasn't so strong that Reagan couldn't come in and say, you know, let's go in and
do
our thing.
About 3 or 4 years.
It was just a few years. And like you say, all the things you were saying is, you know, Brzezinski coming in as a dominant force in the later, you know. Right.
Yeah, when you mentioned Senator Frank Church, another table I hadn't mentioned is the different methods we employed in our interventions. All these assassinations on A3, I would say virtually most of the early ones, to someone younger like yourself, might have lived with these or known about these all your life, but they were not widely known before 1975 in the Senator Frank Church hearings. They are sometimes alleged we tried to assassinate DM, or we did assassinate DM, we did assassinate Trujillo, we tried to assassinate Castro, we were involved in the assassination of Lumumba. That all, nobody knew that in the 60s. That didn't come out until 1975. Some more questions here? Yes. And then call it back.
This is a point off of the end of the newspaper. You're asking the question about how do you turn something like this into something that benefits activism or otherwise would lead to U.S. disengagement and well, I don't know to what degree. I'm commenting because about an issue or two ago, Foreign Policy was reading counter-arguments about both light engagement and questions about the benefits or the costs of heavy engagement or deep engagement and the relative stability that it offers, whether through, let's say, direct interventions, be it security guarantees, arms sales, ensuring support with the U.S. as a superpower through something like a local agenda and friendly to our interests. I'm posing that as a counter-argument on here just because I'm curious what your thoughts are or whether some level of disengagement would result in something of a multipolar world or would be destabilizing to other regions of the world irrespective of our own interests. What are your thoughts?
Well, go ahead.
Sure. I just to ask you to clarify real quick, you're talking about, you know, United States withdrawing as, you know, as global hegemon, as being the only hegemon in this world system, as a possible solution to
the result.
It kind of does sound like the mantism, and that's what's partly being promoted here. And I'm not sure whether it would be something more along the lines of peaceful engagement or infrastructure building, because I truthfully don't know about the politics. From the context of interventions or the military presence.
Yeah. Well, you said a key word there when you said order. One of the things that would be less order to our liking. I mean, if you're less hegemonic, there's going to be less ordering of the world that you might want it to be. The question is whether you can live with that.
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, we're in a new age. We've had the scientific revolution, and we understand psychology, political science, so forth. But, you know, the classic way of the classic empires of the past, go back thousands of years, they did promote a certain peace. They would often suppress rival groups from rival, you know, you had less mini empire wars within the great Han Empire or the great Roman Empire, and they would suppress. And so there was a sense that Roman order, peace, was Pax Romana, was in a sense a peace, albeit if you, you know, rebelled, you might, you know, 75,000 people crucified or something like, you know, Spartacus group. But there was the sense, and that's still, a classic realpolitik argument. If the United States withdraws from the Pacific area, then China and South Korea, North Korea, and Japan will be locked into this military buildup, and there could be things. Well, so if the argument is really needs to be addressed, and I think that you can't just say, you know, an isolationist argument essentially, well, let's pull out U.S. and everything's going to work out. I mean, you could pull out U.S. That might even be beneficial in many, many situations. But I think my paper is directed toward the idea that the United States is operating increasingly as a law to itself when international law is building, when international cooperation, when you have a European Union you didn't have in the imperial days, when you have a new arms trade treaty that's just getting going, international criminal court, the ability of the United Nations at least to make a collective decision, maybe not right, maybe not solve all the problems, but this is to me is, you know, what the way I would answer your question is that we have to move towards something proactive and positive, and not simply a sort of get the U.S. out. I mean, there's a lot of critique here because we're mostly Americans who are responsible for our government, and when, you know, it's killing people, innocent people, I think that tends to dominate the situation, but. Yeah.
I'd like to wonder as well how we can get beyond this sort of like international law framework as well. I mean, not that it's not helpful, right? And like we were talking about the rise of human rights and human rights advocacy since the 70s has been like a major part, right? And in some ways checking U.S. hegemony. But, you know, at least from the two examples, the example in my paper in terms of the militarization of the oil economy, right? And like we were talking about the centrality of the weapons trade to the U.S. economy, right? The only real production that happens in the United States these days and is exported abroad, like I think we need to do more than just question this international framework of international law and question the economic structures that exist behind war, right? I mean, the way that oil has been, since oil has been key to the functionings of the international economy, you've seen endless war in the Gulf since the 70s. I mean, if you start with the civil war in Yemen, United States support for Saudi Arabia during that time, you move straight on to the Iran-Iraq war, in which we, you know, we all know the United States was, of course, supporting Saddam Hussein, and then as it came out, supporting Iran as well, or funding, fueling weapons to Iran. And then after that, you have Kuwait and Iraq sanctions carrying us all the way up until 2003. So, you know, I don't know, I think that it's worth it, it's worth talking about, you know, imperial precedence is far back and is divorced from the current era as they may be. I think it's worth talking about human rights, but I also would like to wonder how we can get beyond these things as well and question some of the other underlying structures that that fuel U.S. imperialism or imperialism general abroad. Because I agree, I think that, you know, if the United States, for instance, is to withdraw from Saudi Arabia, it's not that China won't come in or somebody won't come in and fuel them with endless supplies of guns to continue that anti-democratic, the support of that anti-democratic regime. So I really think it's important to question the centrality of oil to the international economy in general to sort of get at some of the larger structural issues that are here.
Yes, I am.
Well, I came in late, and I was going to go on a somewhat different topic. Is that okay?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me what's really interesting is how I was just looking at your tables, which are very impressive. At the same time, I can't help but say there's a glaring omission, and that's Puerto Rico. And to me, what's amazing is how often Puerto Rico is ignored and is left out, despite the fact that the United States invaded it and is still a colony of the United States. And to me, it sort of sets in motion in a very specific, directed way, both militaristically, politically, and economically, U.S. imperialism in Latin America in a specific way. And I just think it's so interesting why Puerto Rico is always left out and ignored. It's not just you. It's all over the place. And I think in a way, we in this country have so much internalized the idea that Puerto Rico is part of the United States, so we don't think of it in any other way. And I think there's this way that, in that sense, how U.S. imperialism basically, somebody said it earlier, somebody said something along the lines, and I know I'll misquote them, but along the lines that, well, there are ways that I think Rashid Khalidi was saying it, that we so internalize without even questioning some of the language, even though we think we're so counter, that we don't question some basic assumptions, such as the fact that Puerto Rico is part of the United States, mm-hmm. and that why is Puerto Rico part of the United States? Why did the U.S. invade it in the first place? And what military and economic and political purpose has it served the United States, not only in Latin America, but in other places? When you think that the invasion of Guatemala, if they came from Vieques, Puerto Rico. I mean, but it's sort of like, why is that? It's always, I say to my students, and believe me, there's plenty of times I could say it, it's always the things you don't know that are some of the most important things, and you have to say, why is it you don't know that? Of course, with my students, that would be quite a few.
Also, the same year is when we picked up Guantanamo. Nobody ever questions how it is that we can take all these people
right.
from the Middle East, put them in Guantanamo. Where did that come from?
Right.
Same war, 1898, where
right.
we got Puerto Rico.
Exactly.
Reason why is that my book is entitled "Since World War II," so we're already there.
Okay.
So.
But the U.S.
Yeah.
still occupied the United States since World War II, and the ethic was pretty important.
Yeah. Oh no. I agree. Anything more on any American interventions? Anywhere? Let me just make one thing, and then you two, if you want to come back, we got about 15 minutes if you have any final remarks, but something that came up, I was just thinking, Guatemala has been mentioned and Iran has been mentioned, and I always like to compare the 1953 and the 1954 interventions. They were the first ones by the CIA, as I think you mentioned in the case of Guatemala, and of course we asked the predecessor to the Shah there in 53. And I think those two are great because everyone says, oh yeah, oil, of course, it was very important. We had to do that in Iran. It was all about the oil. We didn't want the Russians to get the oil, so on. But then the next year we do it for bananas. It doesn't make any difference whether it's oil or bananas. It's all about control. And that's what being a hegemon is controlling. And the product is almost secondary. I mean, oil is more important than bananas, but we'll do it for bananas. We did it for nutmeg, I think, in Grenada. That was another, speaking of Grenada and Reagan replacing Carter, I make a point in my book, I think it's worth, I've heard things along this line here today, in other panels too, is we Reagan picked his targets really wisely. He picked, you know, the tiniest little no-account countries in the world, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Libya, and then Grenada, less than 100,000 people, and people think we're standing tall. We defeated Grenada. And what's the product we're trying to control and keep out of communist hands in Grenada? Nutmeg. I mean, you can't get, that's even less of less use than bananas. I mean, how many people use nutmeg? But there was an American company, McCormick's, down there producing those spices, and the hegemon had to keep that order for American capitalist business to operate in Grenada, even if you're only talking about spices, which you can do
you,
without.
You don't think, I thought it had much more to do actually with the Cuban relationship with the Grenadian government, actually. And of course, we can't forget the medical students.
Yeah, well, we can't let Cuba colonize Grenada because then they'll have control of the nutmeg as well as the sugar.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
I always read it as a practical invasion of Nicaragua as a test.
Yeah, I think that's what
Nicaragua.
I think about, too, yeah.
Grenada as a test case, you say?
A test of the waters of, at the time, a lot of us
right.
thought that it
right.
was a test case for the invasion
right.
of Nicaragua because they knew that there was going to be hell to pay if there was an invasion.
It was also a wag the dog, so we forgot what happened in Lebanon the week before. We had just been bombed out of Lebanon, in the Marine barracks in Lebanon in October of 83, and that went right off the radar screen as soon as we invaded Grenada three or four days later.
I remember in 1982, I was living in Amsterdam, and my landlady, she was watching what she thought was this really hilarious TV show about how Reagan was scared of this tiny island in the Caribbean, and she was just laughing away, and then suddenly she realized that this is completely serious, that this wasn't a farce, that Reagan was scared of Grenada, and she just couldn't figure out what's wrong with this country.
Better look at Luxembourg over there.
Yeah.
I mean, some aspects of this panel reminds me of the John Hobson's work of imperialism for one reason. When Hobson was in 1902, when he was writing his imperialism study, he was saying that this form of imperialism that we see in United Kingdom, as the British imperialism, is different from the former time. And he was trying to emphasize, he was talking about the new phase of imperialism. And then he was saying it's different because previously we were also there was colonization, this and that, but now previously we were in a way gaining from this. And he was not an anti-imperialist. But then he was saying now this is not happening, and he was kind of trying to say what we are doing today since 1870 onwards, he was writing, is triggering other states and then he was observing that, to do the same. So now when we are talking about Disney, I mean, because I think in this space, if we are talking about imperialism as relationship with interventions, it's not going to be the old form of imperialism as we know it. I mean, it's not going to be the old forms of colonization, imperialism. That's not happening right now. But something is happening, and this kind of, this table, these interventions, and new forms are taking in that places. And I wonder, because we are talking about, because that's being done by the United States, like as the major, as the hegemon, as the policeman, but also more and more, do we see that other states are also engaging in this rivalry? Because if it's happening, that's becoming really dangerous. What I have in mind is that because in this recent operation in Libya, I mean, United States was not in the forefront, it was France. Now, when they do, I mean, it's a different thing, but I mean, to Mali, to these like fundamentalists, it was again like France was doing it. And actually, I'm from Turkey, and sometimes like these Turkish, like, I don't know, saying that, okay, we will not use the bases, let United States use the bases, is sometimes used as an example of like something like as a democracy. Actually, it's not to like my, I mean, government is dying to send there. I mean, if they have find an opportunity like there's, I mean, it's not that, but sometimes actually in Turkey where we discuss, because it's usually United States is always more influential in Turkey by far, but sometimes like it's, we can see that like Germany is really becoming influential. And actually these are not happening all the time. It's always 90% of the time is United States. But we can see the fractions now. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, so because I don't study this, do we see this US type of interventionism in this period, like in a way, as there is an hegemonic decline, as this is happening, does it create also opportunities for other states, great powers, to compete in this business?
Or compete or cooperate, because close to Turkey, the disorder is coming to Syria, and what the other greater powers are talking about is who's going to provide the order, and Turkey is part of it. Is it going to be Turkey? Is it going to be Britain, France, United States, Soviet Union? They're trying to get, I mean, even the Western Europeans are trying to get, not the Soviets, trying to get Russia involved to solve this problem of disorder in Syria. There's got to be some hegemonic presence, and it might be a coalition of, like happened in Libya, or it might be one of them steps up, like France stepped up in the case of Mali, but no one has stepped up because I think they all realize that it's going to be quite messy for someone to come in and try to straighten out Syria. But well, Turkey's one of the ones that are pushing forward and say, do something, because you're going to suffer the overflow from these refugees if this situation is not solved or goes on for more years than the two that's gone on already.
I think you're right about they're different situations and different times. But I studied John Hobson a bit and read, you know, a number of his imperialism study and other. And he, what I recall is his main point, he was trying to convince the British people that imperialism was not in their interest, that the Great Britain was expending all this money to control, you know, all these places all in Africa and Asia, and the British people were not getting the benefit of this. And I think that there's some parallel today with the United States. I mean, what did the United States get out of Iraq here? We don't, you know, we're not getting that much oil, we don't have guarantees. So that may be an argument. And he was an anti-imperialist of a moderate type, Fabian socialist. The other thing about, you know, your question about the combination of powers, the Europeans at that time had in 1885 the conference in Berlin dividing up Africa, the scramble for Africa. And so there was a sense that, you know, the French, maintaining a French colony in West Africa would also be reinforced the British colonies in East Africa. And this continued right through the Second World War when the British helped the French get back into French Indochina, you know, because they didn't want the British Empire being challenged. And then it all broke down. I'm not sure, you know, if that parallels today. We have a shift. We have a fundamental shift in the imperial mentality, especially in Europe. In this country, you know, it's hard to see because we've taken it over, as you mentioned, from all the different countries under another alias, also known as, you know, democracy. But I think when you were coming into something that's different, it's not. I don't think we have to look at history as a continual, line of inertia. I think we're looking at something like with French and Mali, as different, as a sort of a prototype of a protective force. Now, this might be a disagreement among pacifists, but I mean, it's a different thing when they come in at the requirement of government and people there. And there are, you know, people in, you know, these in Africa and elsewhere, that there has to be an international police. I mean, a real international police, not the quoted type. I'll go back to that. But I think we're looking at establishing a different type of order that's not based on the imperialism. And I think that's the quest. I don't know if that answers your question because it was kind of complex, but that's my sort of take on, we're not in the sort of scramble for Africa anymore. When Hollande went over to Algeria, he spoke to the parliament. This was last year, last July, and he apologized for 62 years of colonization. He apologized. He says, "Well, you know, this was a cruel thing." You know, I don't know. That's what, maybe it's a hope.
Question mark about the future. Maybe we should end. We're only 5 minutes from when the scheduled ending was, a quarter of. I'm supposed to have about a break, 30-minute break before we start the plenary for this evening, which you are going to be one of the stars, John. Is that correct? I'll give you 30 minutes to prepare.
Snack time.
Right. Nap. Okay. Okay. Oh, if anyone. Book is $30. If anyone does not want the tables that I passed out, I'd like to have them borrowed.